Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
That was then, this is now, a little game we're going to call the Fiscal Cliff Time Machine. The ups and downs of elevator engineering on the broadcast today and bowl games as business model from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 4th of December. And here is what we're going to do today and the rest of the week. We're going to play a little game, because I don't know if you've noticed, but what Washington is saying this year about the fiscal cliff sounds a whole lot like what people were saying last year about the debt limit. So we're going to play some tape, some from this year, some from last. You are going to guess which one is which, all right? All right, so here we go. The Tuesday entry in the fiscal cliff time machine is the leader of the free world. Here you go, choice number one.
Let's ask the wealthiest Americans and biggest corporations to give up some of their breaks in the tax code and special deductions.
Okay, now choice number two.
We'll have more time to work out a plan to bring down our deficits in a balanced way, including by asking the wealthiest Americans to pay a little more so we can still invest in the things that make our nation strong.
Remember now, the object of the game is to figure out which one was last year and which one is this year. Choice one or choice two. If you think you know, tweet us at Marketplace APM. All right, onward now to the other big topic this month, shopping or stealing, if you will. Retailers are going to lose nearly $9 billion this holiday season to the five-finger discount. That's the estimate from Checkpoint Systems, which helps companies reduce losses due to shoplifters and crooked employees. That same study, by the way, says companies pass on some of those costs to consumers, which adds almost $100 to the average holiday shopping bill. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports.
Busting thieves is called loss prevention. That's what law enforcement veteran Robert Hansen teaches at Northern Michigan University. I asked him about some of the unusual techniques thieves use.
Well, we don't want to give people too many ideas.
Even babies can be tools. One of his former students saw a woman packing goods into a stroller. Things took a strange turn when security confronted her outside the store.
The woman picked up the child from the stroller and threw it at the loss prevention agent and ran away.
Keith White is Senior VP of Loss Prevention at Gap, Inc. His teams have caught people trying everything from stuffing hundreds of dollars of clothes in their socks to James Bond-like suitcases with false bottoms. He always expects a spike in crime around the holiday season when big crowds and hot items are in stores.
You have to magnify it by about three or four in the last quarter of the year.
Shoplifters are just part of what companies watch for. Inside jobs by employees actually account for more retail crime. Less common but dangerous are organized gangs that target high-value items. They can cart off thousands of dollars in merchandise in less time than it takes to run a TV commercial. Dan Reynolds is a VP at Checkpoint Systems.
Within 20 seconds, they'll have half of that aisle cleared out, makeup, cosmetics, fragrances, and out the door. So they're pretty sophisticated. They're fast.
Booster bags are tools of the trade. They're specially lined to foil security tags on products. Companies work to stay ahead of criminal technology. The challenge is to do this without turning stores into fortresses. Preventing theft is no good if it also prevents sales. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Everything we're buying now, or stealing, actually, for the holidays, has been in the country a good long while. But restocking that supply chain could get precarious. The strike at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach is now in its second week. Negotiations are reportedly not going well, so today the two sides agreed to let a federal mediator step in. But bad as the strike is for companies waiting on their cargo, it has created some business opportunities, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
Several hundred million dollars worth of cargo is stalled at or diverted from the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach every day. The labor dispute centers around clerical employees protesting the outsourcing of jobs to lower-paid non-union workers. Economist Paul Bingham with CDM Smith tracks freight transportation. He says the clerical workers have been trying to negotiate a new contract for more than 2 years. Will a federal mediator make a difference?
I think it can certainly help. We've just seen an example with the unions on the East Coast and the Gulf Coast with their own labor dispute contract negotiation earlier this year that the federal mediator was able to come in and get a 90-day cooling off period.
The strike in Southern California has not stopped all traffic. Bingham says some companies are rerouting their cargo to those ships not impacted by the strike.
If I'm shipping today out of Asia, that's probably going to affect, you know, which companies are likely to be filling their ships.
For example, he says Costco, China's largest steamship company, is getting some extra business. So are some ports. Ensenada, Mexico, is only about 50 miles south of the border. Consultant Ken Morris with Cross Border Group says the Mexican port is making the most of the U.S. labor dispute.
The port of Ensenada is positioning itself as an alternative port. It's been doing that by investing in the infrastructure.
If the strike in Southern California drags on, some cargo could be rerouted through the Panama Canal, creating opportunities for ports on the Gulf and East Coasts. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Wall Street might as well have taken the day off today for all the difference it made. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Firmly believing in giving credit where credit is due, we saw an article in the Wall Street Journal the other day we pretty much had to follow up on about a facet of our daily lives, especially for those who live in cities that honestly most of us probably don't give much thought to, the humble elevator and how it gets us where we're going. Teresa Christie does elevatoring, and yes, that is the technical term, at the Otis Elevator Company. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So listen, how come my elevator always takes so long to come?
Probably because you're an impatient person.
Well, no. Okay, but that aside, right? I mean, I'm not the only one out there who thinks that.
That's right. Actually, that's the thing that we concentrate on the most. What we're doing is trying to find a balance between how long the individual riders wait and how many elevators we actually have to put in the building. If you think about it from the building owner's point of view,
yeah,
he wants as few elevators in his building as possible because elevators use up core space. And if he's got core space being used, he can't rent it. Meanwhile, the riding public would like as many as possible,
yeah,
because the more elevators, the faster you're going to get one.
So is there a magic number that you guys have for how long people are willing to wait before they really start tapping their toes and checking their watches?
Yeah, there's a magic number, and it's 20 seconds for major office buildings. It's a little longer in a residential building, but we tend to use the 20-second average, and that's a number that's been used for over 50 years,
wow,
in the industry.
Can you not, if you wanted to speed up service and make our wait times less, could you not just make the elevators go faster?
Actually, no, because what happens is elevators stop along the way. So if you think about the fact that maybe you have 10 floors and, you know, if 10 people get into the elevator, they may press 8 different buttons, meaning,
yeah,
it's going to make 8 stops along the way. So by the time the elevator accelerates, it doesn't always get up to full speed because then it's time for it to decelerate into its stop. So even putting the speed higher doesn't mean you're actually going to reach that higher speed when the elevator moves.
All right. Let me ask you a practical question. If I am on the 19th floor, let's say, and I want to go down to the lobby and there's an elevator coming down from, you know, 35 or whatever it is, and there's like 6 people on it already and it's already made a bunch of stops, is the thing that you would do would be to make that elevator stop for me and continue on its merry way? Or do I have to wait for somebody else since those guys have already stopped 3 or 4 times?
It really depends. If the amount of time that those people have that are in the car have already waited and then spent in the car is beyond a certain threshold, then you're probably going to have to wait for a new car. But we're going to also look at your threshold. If you've been waiting a long time, we're going to use some mathematics called fuzzy logic. We're going to balance out.
Somehow,
yeah,
doesn't surprise me.
Oh, there's a lot of math in it, believe it or not. It's one of the reasons I love it. And we're going to try and figure out which is the best car.
This is, and I say this not to be pejorative at all, but this is the quintessential time is money debate, right? Because the time you spend sitting around waiting for an elevator and riding in an elevator is fundamentally wasted time.
Well, that's true.
But I said it not to be, you know, not to be a bad guy.
Well, the thing is, I guess, is you know, what you're doing with that time. I mean, There's an urban legend that I really can't verify is true that says that if people are complaining about waiting for the elevators, put mirrors in the hallways. Because once they're looking at themselves and adjusting, you know, their tie or combing their hair a little bit with their fingers.
Time, yeah.
Right. They're not thinking about the fact that the elevator is a little long in coming. So I've never used that tactic, but I've read about it.
Teresa Christie is an Otis Fellow at the Otis Elevator Company. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, so picture this, a California strawberry field at harvest time, but not a migrant worker in sight. Instead, small robots are out there scurrying around, picking and sorting and transporting. It's kind of like a Roomba, that little vacuum cleaner robot, but for crops, which is handy because they were invented by the same guy. Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
In a drab warehouse near Boston, inventor Joe Jones and his team are quietly testing battery-powered robots that could wipe out an entire category of agricultural labor.
So we've given all the robots names.
Okay, and they are?
I don't even remember them all anymore, but right here we have Tumbleweed and Grommet and Wallace are over there, and Astro and Shark are over there.
Astro, Grommet, and the gang are the brainchild of Jones and the team here at Harvest Automation, a startup in Billerica, Massachusetts. Harvest says it sells a tough, smart, simple robot. It weighs less than 100 pounds, stands about knee-high. Two sensors help it see, and it's got a gripper in front so it can perform its main task, which is simple. It picks up potted plants from one spot in a nursery field.
And it carries them over to the other side of the field and puts them into a pattern with enough space between each of the pots so that the plants have room to grow.
Jones says right now in the U.S., migrant laborers, some legal, some not, do this sort of work.
So they bend over to pick them up, they walk a few feet, they bend over to put them down, and they repeat that for 8 hours a day. It gets pretty grueling. Not a lot of people want to have that job.
Tell me about it, says Tom Demeline. He's a wholesale nursery owner in Ohio who just bought four of the robots at $30,000 each. If they last beyond a year and a half, Demeline figures they'll pay off. He pays his human workers $11.74 an hour. Not a bad wage for low-skilled work, but he says the only people who will take these jobs legally are Mexicans he's hired through a federal guest worker program.
But that's a costly and expensive program to use also. So it really comes down to having the robots when you need them and putting them away for the winter when you don't.
And for growers who've relied on illegal labor in the past, says Harvest CEO Charlie Grinnell, recent crackdowns have left them in a pinch.
So Georgia in particular, what they found is the migrant workers just won't come there anymore.
So far, Harvest has sold 25 robots. Joe Jones says he designed them so that field workers, not just whiz kids, can program them.
Well, first off, press a... So this is the home button. We press the home button.
Okay. This is the what button? The home?
That's the home screen button.
Well, now, let's just say there's a learning curve. But Andrew McAfee at MIT's Center for Digital Business says farmers and growers have usually embraced new technology, just like other business people.
Business owners want to become more efficient. They want to raise their revenues and lower their costs. They want to grow their markets. Somewhere very far down on that list is employ a large number of people.
Next step, says inventor Jones, robots that can prune and fertilize plants. And then?
We might go to something that resembles a pot, maybe pumpkins or melons or something like that. After you have learned to do that, then you can go stepwise through more and more challenging crops. And eventually, we will get to the strawberries and to the citrus and to the apples, but we're not starting there.
Meanwhile, they're still perfecting Astro and Grommet here, says Harvest's quality assurance guy, Rory McKean.
If your leg is sufficiently pot-like, it might think you're a pot and try to pick up your leg.
Dodging robots in Billerica, Massachusetts, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Robots doing the gardening is one of those things you kind of have to see to believe. Good thing, then, that we've got a video on our website, marketplace.org. Coming up, another voice from the North Dakota oil boom.
Now, I've been in oil field all my life. I was roughnecking in Oklahoma when I was 11 years old.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 13 points today, about a 10%, ended at 12,951. The NASDAQ deleted 5 points, 0.2%, 29.96, the number at the bell. The S&P 500 gave back 2 points, also about 0.2%, wrapped at 14.07. Netflix delivered a 14% gain today. A new deal lets Netflix members watch Disney films right after they leave movie theaters, more or less. That's the Disney films, not the members. Anyway, good news for discount retailers. Big Lots stacked up an 11.5% increase today with an improved yearly forecast. Darden Restaurants sank 9.5%. The parent company of Red Lobster and Olive Garden badly missed sales expectations. Wall Street hates it when that happens. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its third quarter productivity and cost report. Leaders from over 500 federally recognized tribes are expected in the Capitol for the annual White House Tribal Nations Conference. And the 21st Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was ratified on December 5, 1933, ending Prohibition. Maybe you watch Boardwalk Empire for the history. I know I do. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, from the education files today, these items. In the past 5 years, there has been a 175% jump in the number of job ads looking for dental technicians with a bachelor's degree. You want to buy and sell farm equipment? More ads want college grads for those jobs, too. What about cargo and freight agents? Yeah, same thing there. Marketplace's Shireen Marisol Meraji has the story.
Every job you can imagine is advertised online these days.
We see plenty of job listings for dishwashers.
Matthew Siegelman is the CEO of Burning Glass. His company analyzes online job ads looking for those dishwashers to CEOs to help educators and job seekers figure out what employers want. And he says they want more education. Jobs that once required a high school diploma, dental lab technicians, cargo agents, records clerks, well, now they're posting online ads saying BAs required. He uses the example of a purchasing manager at a company.
Used to be that you'd hire somebody who had been around the plant a bunch of years, knew all the vendors, and could negotiate aggressively with them.
Now, Siegelman says, that same employer wants the purchasing manager to understand enterprise resource planning systems and analyze inventory data.
We've been underproducing people with post-secondary training for decades now.
Anthony Carnevale directs the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce. He says employers have been asking for more training for the last 30 years and are willing to pay for it.
That is the proof of the pudding. Employers are putting their money where their mouth is.
Carnevale says that this is not just about a glut of educated workers flooding the market in a tough economy and employers asking for higher degrees just because they can. He says you're not going to see these job ads go back to requiring just high school diplomas once the economy gets better. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
With the college football bowl season well nigh upon us, we turn now to the curious case of Louisiana Tech. The 9-3 Bulldogs got an invitation to play in the Independence Bowl this year. December the 28th is the date. They held out, though, waiting for a better offer, which never came. So now they will be cooling their heels at home this postseason. It's a cautionary tale, Marketplace's David Gura explains, that says a whole lot about the economics of the college bowls.
Fans love a bowl game. Players get more time in the spotlight, and schools get payouts. Michael McCann directs the Sports Law Institute at Vermont Law School.
It's a considerable amount of money. It's millions of dollars.
Now, that varies by bowl. This year, Louisiana Tech would have gotten $1.1 million. But top bowls pay millions more. Brad Humphreys teaches sports economics at the University of Alberta. He says teams want the biggest payout possible. Why?
I think it's very common for teams and universities to lose money on bowls.
Just think of what that $1.1 million has to cover.
You have to take care of all your travel costs and all the costs associated with participation in that bowl.
On top of that, a coach gets a bonus for making it to the postseason. And all that adds up. David Berry is an economics professor at Southern Utah University.
The real
really hard thing to assess when it comes to college sports is whether anyone makes money or not.
That's because so much of the return can't be easily quantified. Schools claim bowl appearances help with recruiting and future ticket and apparel sales. But Humphreys says to remember what's led to all these new bowl games, sponsors, and the cities they're played in.
You know, we're talking about local convention and visitors bureaus who are trying to figure out a way to get an additional 20,000 people to come into town in December.
Even the benefits of that aren't easy to calculate, and there's scant evidence sporting events lead to long-term economic growth in cities. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
I'm hoping that by this point in the program, fingers crossed, you are interested and engaged. Most definitely not bored, though. I get it, though, if you are. Happens to everybody, that getting bored thing. Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie wrote about boredom last week for Smithsonian.com. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me here.
So listen, we should probably define terms, right? This is not boredom like my kids sitting around the house on a rainy afternoon saying, "Dad, I'm bored," right?
Well, it kind of can be. And that's actually kind of the problem with looking at boredom and the problem that a lot of psychologists and philosophers have had in examining the problem, because there's really two ways to look at it. Could be your kid on the couch saying he's bored, or it could be sort of deeper and what's called existential boredom.
All right. You have to help me understand what existential boredom is then, though, right?
Existential boredom is the kind of boredom that philosophers like Jean-Paul Sartre suffer. It's the kind of deep and what am I doing with my life boredom. It's the boredom that Madame Bovary had and that made her have an affair.
There is a betwixt and between, though. Right? I mean, there's being bored at work and just not enjoying what you're doing at the moment, isn't there?
Yeah. It's interesting, too, that some of the first explorations of boredom were people who were examining boredom as a problem of factory workers.
Yep.
There was a study done in like 1938 and determined that the best way for people who were working in factories to deal with the tedium of working in factories was to do drugs.
Whoa.
That stimulants helped.
Wow. That can't be good.
Yeah, it's a little worrying. but it's also an interesting point about one of the sort of underlying mechanisms of boredom, which is sort of how it relates to attention and whether or not you're able to pay attention to what you want to pay attention to or how you pay attention to something.
So, I mean, boredom has been linked to depression and health problems and drug use and all that stuff. Are there upsides? I mean, do we get anything out of it?
There can be. There's been a ton of research into what's called the default state or the resting state. And what they found was that when you're sort of in this state of not doing anything, your brain is actually working pretty hard. It's thinking, it's doing stuff. So that's kind of important for those daydreaming times and the sort of staring out the windows and being bored in class times.
Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie writes about boredom on Smithsonian.com. Linda, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The oil boom out in North Dakota, the one that's helped that state get unemployment down to 3%, has attracted all kinds of people who are looking for work. Some of those people have never seen an oil rig before. Others have spent their lives doing it. Independent radio producer Todd Melby is working on a year-long project called Black Gold Boom out of Williston, North Dakota. And we've been airing some of his portraits of the people and places he has run across. Today, a guy who's been in the oil fields almost as long as he can remember.
My name is Richard Karp. I'm from Woodward, Oklahoma. I work for Jericho Services. I've been here about 2.5 years. We haul fresh water, and then we transfer water on the frack jobs. We work just mainly around here in the McKenzie area. It's doubled in traffic around here since last year. I know that. It's just booming real bad. I mean, there's so much work here. It's unbelievable. I was at the doctor's office one day, and there's an old man sitting beside me, and he says, "You know, I just can't believe it." I said, "What's that?" He said, "I'm 72 years old, and they're putting their first red light in this town." He said, "I was born and raised here, been here all my life, and they're just now putting their first red light in." It's pretty funny. And I've been in the oil field all my life. I was roughnecking in Oklahoma when I was 11 years old for my stepdad. Had my own welding business for 15 years, and I got congestive heart failure, so I can't take smoke no more. So I quit welding and Didn't work for about 5 years. And the doctor said, heck, you're good to go back to work. So I applied for this job and I got it. And I come from Oklahoma up here with them. Work on a drilling rig, drill for oil. I've done it all my life. You got to be careful out there. A lot of people get hurt over stupid stuff, not paying attention. I've had back surgery when I was 21. I crushed my arm when I was in 96, and they was going to cut my left arm off, but I still got it. They wanted to cut it off. My mom said, you wake him up and tell him, because I don't think he's going to let you cut his arm off. I mean, it was a miracle, but I still have it. I'm part of a mud pump drop and smashed my elbow. It smashed it plumb in half. And they put it all back together. I wore a cast for 4 years. I couldn't touch my face or button my pants or nothing. For 4 years, I had a cast on this left arm. I could almost straighten it all the way out, and I can touch my face now. But I could get it right. I couldn't get right here as far as it'd been, about 4 inches. And I finally did a lot of therapy and stuff, and they got it working again. Just getting old now. I'm 50.
Todd's project, it's called Black Gold Boom, is an initiative of Local Lore and the Association of Independents in Radio.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, getting back to where we started, a test of sorts to see how closely you're paying attention to the fiscal cliff debate. There's a survey out today from Public Policy Polling. People were asked what they thought about various deficit reduction plans. Simpson-Bowles did pretty well. That's the baseline budget proposal a lot of Washington is talking about right now. 39% of Americans had an opinion about it. 25% of us have heard of the Panetta-Burns deficit plan, which is the really amazing number, since it's not real. Pollsters just threw it in there to see what would happen. So, moral of the story, stay on your toes, gang. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Thanks to John Bowditch, Mary Dew, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Come on back tomorrow. This is APM.